You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, deer hunters are ready for the start of the gun deer season this weekend. We'll learn more about the impact the hunt has on Wisconsin and get some safety advice, too. Now, coal is the single largest source of electricity around the world, making up 37% of all energy usage globally. It's a concern that came up at the UN COP26 climate summit, which ended last week. The UK and European Union pushed for a total phase-out of coal, but growing economies like China and India, who rely on coal, pushed back. Coal power is a big part of the global economy, but it's also a big contributor to climate change. We're taking a look at the new UN climate agreement to decrease the global reliance on coal and what it would take to get there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think slowing down global warming by cutting coal usage would work? Do you worry about the economic fallout of that? Places like Wisconsin use a lot of coal. What do you want to see that replaced with, if you want to see it replaced at all? Do you have questions about the global reliance on coal energy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Thurber is Associate Director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. He's the author of the book, Coal, about the history and use of the resource. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you first talk about the role that coal plays in the global economy right now?
Sure. As you just mentioned, coal is on the order of about 36% of global electricity generation, and it's about 25% of total primary energy. So that includes use of coal for industry as well as for making power. So it's very big contributor to the global economy.
And how about climate change? There's a lot of forms of fossil fuel energy. Why the focus on coal as a source of climate change emissions?
Coal is the worst on climate change emissions. So coal is responsible for something almost about 30% of human-caused global greenhouse gas emissions.
There was talk of a phase out of coal in this summit last week, changed to a phase down, or some of the words to that effect. Looking at what came out of there, what do you see in the commitments, the efforts to not eliminate but reduce the efforts of coal? What is the world trying to do according to this summit?
Well, so I think everybody recognizes the outsized impact coal has environmentally. And I think the summit language is a recognition of that. And in some sense, it's probably the best we can hope for out of these kinds of summits, is everybody acknowledging they're on the same page and deciding that collectively we want to do something about it. But ultimately, it will be up to individual countries to follow the paths they choose to phasing out coal.
Now, we've seen here in Wisconsin, the WEC Energy Group, a big utility company, biggest in the state, said earlier this month, hey, we're going to phase out coal by 2035, switch over to natural gas. Are we seeing this happen a lot in the U.S. in states that have historically depended, like Wisconsin, on coal for their electricity?
Yes, we're seeing this all over the country. And there are a few reasons for this. Ultimately, what's driving these coal phase outs in the U.S. is economics. Natural gas in the U.S. is cheaper than it is most places around the world. And coal plants in the U.S. are almost entirely, including the ones in Wisconsin, very old. And so it's just reaching the point where it's not as economic to keep these coal plants going. And the U.S. has this luxury of being able to switch over to natural gas, which it's done. If you look at in 2005, about 50% of U.S. electricity came from coal. Now it's closer to 20%.
Now let's talk about countries like China and India. I understand that on a per capita basis, per person in those countries, a lot less climate change emission than per person in, say, the United States. But there's a lot of people, so it adds up to a lot of climate change emission. Can you talk about the role in those two countries of coal in those two countries in particular?
Yes. So it's a very large role. So if you look at China, about 70% of their electricity comes from coal. And then that's in addition to the use of coal in industry. And then in India, it's an even higher percentage of their electricity comes from coal. And it's also used in industry as well. And the challenge those countries have is they don't have the opportunity quite as near at hand as the U.S. did to quickly switch over to some other fuel, because the U.S. already had in place the natural gas infrastructure. And especially when we started producing more natural gas with the shale gas revolution, the conditions were ripe to make a quick switch. And that's much harder in these other countries. And unlike the U.S., these are countries where the economies are still growing fast, demand is still growing fast, and so it's a much thornier problem.
Talking to Mark Thurber from Stanford University's Program on Energy and Sustainable Development, author of the book Coal, looking at efforts from the recent Global Climate Summit to scale back the use of coal around the world. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I was going to point out two things. One is that as long as other people are paying the bill for recovery efforts after a fire or a flood, all the companies involved in fossil fuels, especially coal, are not actually paying their own bill. So we can't really say that coal is cheaper, because coal may be simply letting somebody else pay for some of the things that it is responsible for. And in relation to other countries that use a lot of coal, especially China, we actually could or should put some sort of fee or fine on them for adding pollution to the world stage. And we probably ought to be talking with other people around the world to make this, if nothing else, part of the large trade agreement, so that other countries don't get away with pollution that everybody has to suffer through.
Nate, thanks a lot for that call. Let's look at that first point first, Mark, the idea of, I think economists call it externalities. For me to buy a bunch of coal and burn it is pretty cheap. But Nate's saying if you factor in the costs to health and to pollution and to climate change, it's fairly expensive. How do we sort that out?
I agree 100% with Nate. So as you say, Rob, this is called a negative externality. So it's a social cost of using coal that is not factored in by the parties to the economic transaction. So as you say, a power generator can burn coal, and unless there's some kind of carbon tax in the jurisdiction where they are, they don't have to pay for any of those costs of climate change. And so I'm a strong believer that they should, and I'm a strong believer in carbon pricing. And the second piece of what Nate is talking about is the idea that, let's say that we as the U.S. would put in place some kind of substantial tax on greenhouse gas emissions. And so then what you could do is you could say, well, we're going to make a border tax adjustment of, you know, for things that we're importing from other countries that tries to account for the carbon content that went into those. And so it would be a way in theory of putting pressure on other countries as well to price in carbon. I have to say, as the United States, we're not doing the best job of this yet ourselves, of pricing carbon. So that's probably where we want to start. But I certainly agree with the points Nate is making.
Thanks for that call, Nate. If I were a trade negotiator for an India or a China, and I'm not, but if I were, I might say in that case, well, wait a minute, you, United States and Europe, have been using coal for a long, long time. Why are you hitting me with, in effect, a coal tariff now after you've been burning this stuff for so long?
Yeah, and you'd be right too. And that is what those countries say. That really what we shouldn't look at is, you know, you brought up the point of per capita emissions, and that's one important point, that you know, the US per capita emissions are far higher than most other countries around the world. But they would also bring up this point of historical responsibility. So if you look at carbon dioxide in particular, it's a very long-lived greenhouse gas. And so, you know, you really have to think about cumulatively how much have countries emitted over time. And so, you know, ultimately, the challenge is that both sides have a point, right? That developing countries have a very valid point that they should have a right to develop and to grow and lift their people out of poverty. At the same time, we won't be able to solve the climate crisis without some significant actions by growing lower income countries as well. And so this is sort of the dilemma. And I think one answer to that is, I think the richer countries need to do a lot more, especially financially, to support growing countries in making different choices that are more environmentally friendly.
Nate, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Ivy next in Evansville. Ivy, hello.
Nate, hi. Another economics fallout from that is damage to our infrastructure from high seawater. But I wanted to bring up what I would like to see is a focus on decentralized energy, because decentralized energy, it leaves communities more vulnerable to natural disasters, to cyber attacks, to terrorism. And it also, you know, it's not going to solve all our energy needs, but we have a lot of rooftops and there are wind generators that you can put on rooftops that also don't kill birds. They're spiral. And, you know, and as far as natural gas goes, there are also problems with the fracking and the pollution caused by that and the use of fresh water diverted for that purpose.
Ivy, thanks a lot for the call. Mark, Ivy, looking for more decentralized rooftop solar, wind power here and there. I think you wrote a piece saying bigger's better, you think, when it comes to solar or wind.
Right. Well, and so my argument in that piece, so there is a lot of increasingly decentralized use of renewables. Certainly in California, where I am, we have a lot of, there are a lot of incentives for rooftop solar. And, you know, I think that's making a useful contribution. Looking at things in the big picture, the big challenge with renewables and with wind and solar in particular is costs have gone down a lot, which is fantastic, and it's enabling us to put in a lot more wind and solar. The big challenge is that they're not necessarily there when you want them. And so if you look at California, we're putting in more and more solar to achieve very aggressive renewable goals for the state. But it means that, you know, putting in one more solar unit that's going to generate at the same time as all the other solar units during the middle of the day, you're at some point not getting as much additional value. And moreover, you could have a day where it's cloudy and you're not getting any generation at all. And so one advantage of a larger, more interconnected grid is it helps you better balance this intermittency of wind and solar. And so if wind and solar aren't there at one location in time and one location in space, they might be there somewhere else. And so if you have a larger grid, you can get power from where it's being generated to where it's needed, and you start to average out these fluctuations in wind and solar better. Another place that I look at a lot is looking at energy in lower income countries and especially looking at sub-Saharan Africa. And that's a place where, you know, I think there is some important near-term role of decentralized power, especially in the absence of very workable large grids. But even there, you have this challenge that it's a little bit harder to manage this fluctuation of renewables without the benefits of a larger grid.
Thanks for that call, Ivy. We're talking to Mark Thurber about the idea of phasing out, or at least phasing down, coal globally. He's Associate Director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University, author of a book called Coal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see coal scaled down here in Wisconsin, around the country, around the world? What are you hoping to see take its place, especially when it comes to producing electricity? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Stanford environment and energy researcher Mark Thurber about the idea of phasing out coal, or at least cutting back on the use of it for climate change reasons, both within the U.S. and around the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark, nuclear power. I'm seeing in the news an idea of going to Wyoming, a big coal-producing state, and saying, hey, if we're cutting back on coal, we could do some nuclear development. People make the case, say, hey, this isn't your parents' nuclear energy. It's cheaper, it's safer than you might think it is. What are your thoughts on that as part of the picture in replacing coal's electricity production?
I think nuclear could be a big part of the solution. If you look at the U.S. power mix right now, it's approximately 40% of electricity is coming from natural gas, approximately 20% from coal, 20% from renewables, hydro, wind, and solar, and about 20% from nuclear. And so I think there's a lot of value to expanding that. The big challenge with nuclear has been that it's so expensive to build. And so it's hard to get generating companies to build nuclear because it just seems too commercially risky for them. And one particular challenge with nuclear in the US is as we put in more renewable capacity, it's actually making the nuclear plants less financially viable because nuclear plants, like coal plants for that matter, are very expensive to build in the first place. So you make your costs back over time by running a very high share of the time. And so what's tricky is if you start to get to where you're running, you have wind and solar that are operating a lot, then that's potentially knocking nuclear out of the mix and making it less financially viable. So I'm very supportive of efforts to further develop nuclear, and especially some of these advanced nuclear technologies I think are very promising. But I think there's this financial hurdle that will have to be dealt with.
We heard from Larry in Illinois, who says China uses a lot of coal. We talked about that. And he says Australia sells a lot of coal, and Australia isn't going to stop selling it. And I understand one of the biggest coal ports in the world is, in fact, Australia. Can you talk about Australia's role in negotiations to limit coal use?
Yeah, I mean, Australia is, along with Indonesia, those are the two biggest coal exporters in the world. And yes, I mean, that, you know, this is an important part of Australia's economy. And so there's a lot of political resistance to stopping exporting it. So I think, you know, that's a challenge in the big picture. And that's a challenge in this country and sort of in all countries. You have this political confrontation between the economic interests that benefit from coal and the folks who are very worried about the environmental impacts of that.
Talking to Mark Thurber, Associate Director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. Talking about the future of coal, a commitment to scale back the use of coal globally came out of that big climate change summit last week. Some had been pushing for a phase out of coal. Still time for your thoughts, your questions on the topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, I sometimes hear kind of a blueprint for the future where we switch from coal to natural gas, as you were talking about earlier, for a while, for the medium term to cut back the climate impact of using fossil fuels, and that's our bridge to getting to something else, alternative energy, nuclear, whatever the future looks like. Do you see that as kind of the viable path forward?
Yes, I do. So if you look at all the rich economies right now that are putting in a lot of renewable energy, including the US, places in Western Europe, the de facto backup for the variability of those renewables in almost all cases is gas-fired generation. And gas-fired generation just works really well for this purpose. It's very flexible to ramp up and down. And then financially, it's the opposite of what I talked about for coal and nuclear, in that gas plants are pretty cheap to build. And so you have this low fixed cost, and it can sort of wait around until renewables aren't there or demand is especially high, and just run less of the time. So I think what one could envision for the transition would be a period where, you know, we move away from using gas as much for just bulk megawatt hours of electricity, and move to using natural gas as providing reliability services. So it's running a lot less, but it's there just for when it's needed for renewables backup. And then I think, you know, further into the future, hopefully, you know, we could move to entirely zero carbon sources.
Let's go to another caller now. Jeremy is with us in Kenosha. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that a lot of this discussion is predicated on the idea that coal is necessarily dirty. And I'm not sure that's the case anymore. I had a friend that used to work at a coal power plant, and he said that it can be very clean. You just need expensive scrubbers in the smokestacks. So I wonder if that's considered, especially when you compare the waste from nuclear that I don't know how you get rid of that.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Mark, have we cleaned up coal enough to where it's not as big a problem for pollution and or climate change?
Sure. No, that's a great question. So I sort of think about clean coal on two dimensions. And the one that the caller was referring to is cleaning it so it doesn't create local air pollution, you know, doesn't create sulfur oxides, nitrous oxides, things that cause smog, particulates. So that is absolutely, as the caller said, there are technologies to take care of those local pollutants. The thing that's much harder is the CO2 part of it. So the greenhouse gas emissions, you know, and coal is about twice as much CO2 that it emits per electricity you make as natural gas. And so that's much more challenging and expensive to scrub out. There are technologies for doing this. So this is what, when people talk about CCS or CCUS, carbon capture, utilization, and storage. And so there are ways to do that. The reason I'm a little pessimistic that those will be implemented at large scale is the appeal of using coal is that it's cheap. And so if you're adding on things that add a lot of cost to capture the CO2, then coal's not going to be cheap anymore. And so I'm a little bit skeptical of the long-term future of carbon capture from coal. I think if carbon capture does play a role, it's more likely to be carbon capture from natural gas-fired plants, for example.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Rob. I enjoyed it.
That's Mark Thurber, Associate Director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. He's the author of the book Coal, About the History and Usage of the Resource. He talked to us about efforts to phase out the use of coal in international climate change agreements. Originally, phase out was the idea, then change to phase down. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a former state Supreme Court justice joins the show for a look at the Kenosha trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. That's tomorrow morning with Kate Archer-Kent. That's at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Here's a headline that made the rounds online yesterday, a New York Times health advice column. Does it matter if I eat the stickers on fruits and vegetables? Now me, I always figured, no, don't eat the stickers on anything. But the person who wrote in says they weren't doing it on purpose. They just sometimes take a big bite of fruit and realize, just ate half the sticker. You know, the little UPC code thing they scan at the register. The good news, according to the article, is that even though the sticker isn't really there to be eaten, it probably won't hurt you if you eat a little bit of sticker every now and then. I've gotten used to peeling it off for my own benefit and after years of getting apples and pears ready for kids. I'm just picturing this person, though, so excited to eat that delicious peach or whatever that they dive in with reckless abandon. Let no sticker stand in their way. Sticker-free since 2003. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin author about a new collection of short stories and the influence the state had on her writing. Now, the gun deer hunting season in Wisconsin gets underway on Saturday. Nearly 900,000 people were out across the state in tree stands and camouflage for last year's hunt, and the Department of Natural Resources estimates a strong deer population and a likely increased harvest this year. We're finding out more about what the gun deer season means to Wisconsin wildlife, culture, and economy. Jeff Pritzel is the deer program specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jeff, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. It is good to be with you.
Well, a 9-day gun deer season. What is your outlook this time around?
Well, like you said in the introduction, I think, you know, the deer population numbers are trending on an upward trend. Our harvest to this point through the archery and crossbow seasons have been following that. Our buck harvest has been ahead of the five-year average. So weather conditions, everything is pointing in the right direction, except for possibly the lack of snow on the ground this weekend, which we all hope for. But that's usually a treat. It doesn't happen in most years. So hunters will adapt, and opportunities are looking pretty good.
For non-hunters, can you talk about why hunters are hoping for at least a little bit of snow?
Sure. It just improves the sight picture a lot better as far as seeing movement, the deer moving against a white background in the cover. And it also helps with tracking in the snow, seeing tracks and recovering animals more efficiently. And I think some people just think it looks prettier too.
Can you talk a little bit about the role of deer hunting for Wisconsin's culture and economy?
Sure. Well, and I think it's culturally, it's important. It's amazing that, you know, you said well over 500,000 people will be out this weekend doing something with a common interest, although there's a whole variety of actual goals people are looking for and what they're hoping to get out of the hunt. Everything from the venison to perhaps a trophy that'll create memories that they'll put on the wall. And in some people, it's just to be communing with nature and with each other, with family in an environment, being outside. We saw a lot of increased activity last year as a way to cope with the pandemic. And I think we have people coming in from all walks of life with varying views, but next weekend, they're all just, they're deer hunters. And so that's important. It just adds to the quality of life. From an economic standpoint, deer hunting collectively, you know, will contribute to about $1 billion worth of economic activity in the state. And so, you know, again, the fact that so many people will be doing this, you know, in one weekend or over the course of the week, but really this weekend is where everyone's going to be doing it. Right. There's nothing that rivals in the state that many people are doing something collectively.
I know regulations for the gun deer hunt can change, get tweaked from year to year. Anything that hunters should be paying special attention to this year when it comes to changed rules?
Sure. Well, one of the good news features is there aren't any significant changes. For the most part, it's like, you know, it was in 2020. Where we do see changes are on a county by county basis as it relates to either the baiting and feeding bans, prohibitions that are associated with presence of chronic wasting disease, and a few counties have been added to that role. There's only like 15 counties left in the state where baiting is permissible. And so checking the regulations to make sure the county you're hunting in is either open for baiting or not is important to be aware of that. And then also, not now for the 9-day gun season, but there'll be harvest opportunities later in the year in what we call our farmland zones, and counties have the option to participate in what we call the holiday hunt, which is another firearm season that's dedicated for antlerless deer only between Christmas and New Year's. And those that can turn on and off in a county. And so they need to check and be aware of whether that's happening. But again, that's for later, but something to keep in mind if they find out they didn't have much success during the 9-day.
Talking to Jeff Pritzel, deer program specialist for the state DNR, looking at the upcoming gun deer season. Jeff, you mentioned CWD, chronic wasting disease. It's been a concern in the state since I started working at this network X number of years ago. What are you watching for now when it comes to CWD?
Sure. Well, there's two things that we're in a position right now to monitor and keep track of where the disease is in the state and where it isn't. And so that's in terms of its presence and monitoring the rate of spread, because we have a goal of trying to reduce that or limit that rate of spread. And there's recommendations about how to do that. And then the other aspect of it is the prevalence of the disease in those core areas where it's been around for a long time. And so the percent of animals that are carrying or are positive with this disease. And we accomplished that through the voluntary assistance of the hunters providing those samples when they harvest a deer by donating the head of the deer, where we can get the sample, you know, required. And those opportunities are throughout the state through self-service kiosks. And we have those locations on our website so that hunters can help us track the disease as far as where it is and where it isn't.
There are a lot of different rules and guidelines for hunter safety and hiker safety when people are out hunting. Can you hit a couple of key points for us when it comes to making this season as safe as possible?
Sure. Well, the requirement to wear blaze orange clothing for the hunters, or blaze orange or pink is the case now, but mostly everyone is using orange from a visibility standpoint is key and paramount, has really added to the safety aspect, along with the mandatory hunter safety and hunter and education to practice safe firearm handling. And we have seen a really nice, I can't even call it a trend anymore, because really for the last 10, 20 years, we've had really a safe track record, but to where we can really focus on just one or two incidents are one or too many. And we're trying to eliminate all of those. But as it relates to overlapping deer hunting with other activities outside, it is not as mutually exclusive, I think, as some people may perceive. There's other activities that can go on through hunters and their training of where they can hunt, where they can discharge their firearms. You know, it's set up to minimize any risks, but there are special rules in place for designated trails, for example, especially on public lands where hunters have to remain. They can utilize the trails to access their locations, but they cannot hunt from those trails. They have to be at least 50 feet off the trail. And in some cases, like for example, the Ice Age Trail, it's even further. They have to be 100 yards from the trail, and they cannot hunt again from the trail or discharge a firearm toward or across a trail, and treating it basically just like a public road.
And Jeff, before I let you go, if people have questions, what kind of DNR resources would you point them toward?
Well, we've got a robust amount of information on our website. If you search deer, or even certain aspects of deer, our search engine will do really well to get you in the direction of what's out there. We have a deer metrics system for people that want to get into the numbers of what's going on. And if they Google, if they search for deer metrics system, that'll take us, and you can go county by county and really dive into what's going on and what the history has been on those the deer herd in those areas. And then we also have a phone app for the hunters, but others could utilize it too, called Hunt Wild Wisconsin. It's free, and it has a lot of features that just make access to the regulations and access to navigation and even tracking harvest, registering your deer. It's all right there. We try to make it as convenient as possible.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet, Rob.
That's Jeff Pritzel, deer program specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We talked to him about the upcoming start of Wisconsin's gun deer hunting season. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a very good girl.
The Mequon Nature Preserve, north of Milwaukee, is home to Wisconsin's first conservation dog, Tilia. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy recently traveled there to learn how they're harnessing Tilia's powerful sense of smell to reach their conservation goals.
That sniffing you hear is Tilia, the conservation dog at Mequon Nature Preserve. Right now, she's looking for a treat. But when she's on the job, she'll be sniffing out wild parsnip or salamanders.
There you go, good girl.
What exactly is a conservation dog, you might ask? Tilia's main job is to detect both invasive and endangered species at the nature preserve. The staff then comes in and removes those invasive species, like the wild parsnip, and monitors for the endangered ones, like the salamanders. Corey Gritzmacher is the director of operations at the nature preserve. He says Tilly is far better at it than even the highest trained human professionals. Canines can be up to 40 times more efficient than people.
Sometimes the best trained volunteers or staff in the world won't even be able to find what, you know, a canine can. So that's the pretty impressive part about it. And who doesn't want to go to work with a dog?
Just who's in charge is up for debate.
I often joke, you know, it's not necessarily us getting trained. It's kind of them training us. You know, like, this is what you have to do if you want me to do something for you. Right? Yeah. Yes. You always have a lot to say.
Tilia is highly motivated by food, or by toys. Gritzmacher says being motivated is the key to being a good conservation dog.
Dogs in general already have 200 million olfactory sensors. We have about 5 million. So they're already set up and designed for scent detection. It's really just finding a dog that's motivated and wants to do it on a regular basis and is excited to do it, right?
4 years old now, Tilia began training as a puppy. It was slow at the start, with treats hidden in cardboard boxes. Then it got progressively more challenging until she graduated to what Gritzmacher calls pairing. That's when he places scent samples in a salt shaker. They're much more appealing with a treat sitting on top.
Eventually we'd start taking the treat away, and then as she continues to hit on the correct sample, then she gets rewarded. So she's going to get paid again. You know, it's kind of the same thing. You know, we do our work, we get paid. She does her work, she gets paid.
The day I visited, Tilia's excitement was clear. With her vest on, she knew what was happening. Gritsmacher had hidden treats to mimic a search on the prairie for parsnip or salamanders.
She's got a release work. That's kind of her cue to go, we're going to go search and find something. So, and you're pretty excited to do this today, aren't you? So you got to go back down to sit. Good girl. All right.
Twinkie.
It's kind of a little bit of a mind game and an obstacle course for her to work through.
While Tilia's nose is the star, when it comes down to it, the success of the endeavor is as much about the rapport and relationship between the dog and the trainer. If Gritsmacher hadn't trained Tilia, he wouldn't be able to pick up on her subtle body cues, like if she gets distracted by a deer or rabbit and veers off course.
And this is the part where you start training me, right? Yeah, yeah.
Using dogs for conservation work is the same idea as police or search and rescue dogs. While Tilia was the only conservation dog in the state for several years, she now has company, and Gritsmacher only expects that number to grow.
Canines are going to start to play a huge role in the conservation field just because of their amazing detection skills, especially when resources are limited, staff is limited, and you have to search, you know, potentially thousands of acres or miles of shoreline or whatever.
It's tough work for her. Gritsmacher says she gets worn out from a long day at work just like we do. Tilia's owner is the director of the Mequon Nature Preserve. At the end of the day, she gets to go home, be the family dog, and take some well-deserved time off.
Do you agree? Okay, good.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Tilia, the conservation dog. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll learn about the craft that goes into writing short stories from the Wisconsin author of a new collection. That's coming up next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. You never know where you're going to start and where you're going to end up when you read a collection of short stories. Things don't have to resolve perfectly. Unexpected twists could be around any corner. Sometimes the story just ends on that twist. Our next guest has a new collection of stories out. Sandy Cruz was born and raised in Chippewa Falls, got an English degree from UW-Madison, had a stop at The Onion, has been living in the town of Primrose for the last two decades. Her new book of short stories as S.K. Cruz is called Tales from the Liminal. Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, I hit the dictionary and reminded myself of liminal. It's a between space or a between state, and that really fits your stories well. What is it that draws you to those spaces that don't kind of fit either category?
I am fascinated with liminal spaces because I feel that that is where all of our transformation happens. Those dark and confusing times in our lives where what we believed or what we've been doing has stopped working, but we can't quite yet see the way forward. Nothing new has taken hold yet, and they're terrifying usually at the onset, but in retrospect, they're usually revealed to have been essential to some significant period of growth and change in our life, and it just fascinates me.
Before we take a peek at a story or two, can you tell us about your path to getting into writing and releasing this collection?
Well, it's a long path. I started writing when I was very young. I loved literature. I loved writing. I wrote a ton throughout school. I had my first story published in The Onion back in the day when it was still in Madison. And then I had a lot of kids and like a lot of people. Sometimes you can't get to some of those things you really want to do for a while because of work, you know, family, health, whatever. But in the last seven, eight years, I've had more time for it. And so I wrote two novels and then I wrote this collection of short stories during the pandemic. And now it's out there in the world.
And you know, the pandemic was kind of is kind of like this liminal time zone. It feels like in some ways regular life is on hold. Was that on your brain as you're writing these?
Not consciously, but I actually, the way I wrote these stories, I was trying to put myself in that sort of liminal space between the conscious and unconscious mind, you know, to tap into the flow state. And, you know, I think that is really interesting. I never thought about that. The pandemic was totally a liminal time. And that's kind of how we approached it as a family. You know, a lot of the kids were home from school. Some of the kids were home from college, and we try to look at it as an opportunity. You know, it wasn't what any of us expected, not necessarily what any of us wanted, but here it was and what we were going to do with it. What were we going to do with it, each of us? And I wanted to write short stories, and I'm very happy in retrospect that I had the time to do that.
Talking to Wisconsin author Sandy Cruz about her new short story collection, Tales from the Liminal. Now, I'll admit, you kind of have you're in a sweet spot that I like, where there's some supernatural elements, fantastical elements, but it's not like fantasy or horror or science fiction. Can you talk about like how you, I don't know, kind of deploy that supernatural element in these stories of real people?
Yes, it's, you know, when I sat down to write these stories, that is what came out of me. And so maybe I'm just a little strange. I don't know. It's my voice. I do know, like, the literature that always really excited me. Like, the first story that really caught my attention as a young person, I was in sixth grade, I read Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury, and I thought that was pretty amazing. But in eighth grade, I can remember exactly where I was sitting at my desk. I can remember the light in the room, the feel of the glossy paper, the image on the cover of the magazine where I read for the first time Kafka's The Metamorphosis. I couldn't believe what I had read. I had never encountered anything like that before. It just revolutionized for me what you could do with writing. And I've always been attracted to that type of literature. So I guess when I sit down to write and I tap into, you know, the unconscious, I suppose it's not that surprising that that's what comes out of me, because that's what I've always loved. I've spent a lot of time reading those sort of strange existential texts that just do strange things.
That reminds me of one of your stories, that a man posts picture of unusual rock, then gets call from concerned parties. It was a little Kafka-y in some ways. Could you share what went into that story a little bit?
Well, I just was so humored by, you know, those clickbait articles that come up where, you know, there's a picture and it says, man posts picture of his wife and gets called from police, and you're looking at the photo trying to see what did they see in the picture, you know. And I these kept coming up in my newsfeed, and I thought, I have to write a ridiculous story about this. So that was the premise of that one.
And it ends up getting into a little, there's some kind of a supernatural agency or something, and
yes,
maybe a ghost. I don't want to spoil it.
Yes, it's a comedic turn of the screw-esque type story. And poor Mr. McGafferty, you know, is just kind of happily but obliviously living his life, and this dark underworld that he believes he's being drawn into ends up, you know, making him a little less thoughtlessly engaged with his life. But sort of at the heart, the sort of big question at the heart of the story is Socrates' adage, the unexamined life is not worth living. And, you know, as a person who has spent a lot of their life really examining everything, sometimes I wonder, you know, what's so wrong with just being obliviously happy? So that's kind of the question in that story. And I love that story.
Hang on. Yeah. Your character said that was a Vince Lombardi quote.
I know, because he's a little clueless about most things. But, you know, Vince Lombardi said some great things, right?
Yeah. And that reminds me of something else I want to ask you about. That story and a lot of other ones don't explicitly take place in Wisconsin, but I could see a lot of them taking place in Wisconsin, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. You know, when you were sharing some of the questions you might be asking me, I looked through my stories, and yeah, 12 of the 15 stories take place in small towns, because it's my whole mental schema for life and interactions between people. And so many of the interactions, because they're very intimate interactions between two people, just that container of a small town makes that possible in a way. You know, I live out in rural Wisconsin now, where we're somewhat isolated, and, you know, I've spent time in big cities and there's a lot of anonymity there, but small towns have this character to them where, you know, people know you, people know what your family's been through, what your history is. And it makes these interactions possible.
Short stories here. You've done a couple novels, as you mentioned, you've tasted them both. What's next?
I'm going to start working on another novel next, and I got an agent this summer, so that's exciting. And she's trying to sell my sci-fi drama. So I think probably a novel will be next, but I definitely would like to write some more short stories. I love short stories. I think it might be my favorite medium.
And just a quick thought, if somebody's out there thinking, I used to like to write, and I always intended to be a writer. A quick bit of inspiration for him to maybe pick up the pen?
I would say, yeah, don't give up. Don't give up. As a person who waited a long time to get to this point, you know, I'm 51 now. Don't give up. And work hard. Work hard. Do whatever you can to get better at your craft.
Sandy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob, for having me.
That's Sandy Cruz, Wisconsin-based author. We talked to her about her new collection of short stories as S.K. Cruz. It's called Tales from the Liminal. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lot of money has gone into cryptocurrencies. But what are they? How do they work? We'll get the latest on Bitcoin, the most famous one, and a lot of the other alternative monies out there. And you can join in with your experiences and questions. You can actually let us know if you've tried investing in them right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And as many Americans get their third COVID vaccine shots, a lot of countries are waiting for their first round. A health expert shares the latest in the effort to get the vaccine to more low-income countries and why there's a lot at stake there for us here in the United States. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.